Welcome to the official podcast of the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. The following conversation, Two Households, Love by the Numbers and Romeo and Juliet, took place at the Redwood City Library on August 6th. It features artistic director Rebecca J. Ennals and resident artists Sean Garahan and Anne Kabori.
So if you don't know the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival well, we not only do the Free Shakespeare in the Park program, we also have summer camps, programs year-round, and a really big engagement program where we try and make Shakespeare accessible to everyone. And this is part of that. Part of it is, you know, for those of you who'd like to know a little bit more and dig deeper into the plays, we have these, we have the podcasts, we have a blog to kind of get some more meat on the bones of the play. And then, of course, if you want, you can just come and enjoy it and for the wonderful play that it is. Romeo and Juliet, of course, needs very little introduction. I imagine you have heard of it before. You've probably seen it before, either on film or some adaptation. Maybe you've seen West Side Story. Maybe you've heard Taylor Swift's love story song that's based on Romeo and Juliet. It's probably a slightly different demographic. You've probably heard it. and so we seem to never be able to get away from this story. It is so part of our pop culture, and it pretty much has been since the time it was written, since 1594. So it's never really gone away. It's enjoyed great popularity through the decades and through the centuries. So that's great. It also sort of comes with a lot of baggage, but I want to dig a little bit into it and find out, you know, what is the source of its popularity? How did it come about? So if you don't mind, take yourself back to a time when maybe Romeo and Juliet wasn't a household word, back in the 1590s. These might have been vaguely familiar to some because there was an Italian story that maybe some very educated folks would have read. And there was a fellow named Arthur Brooke who in 1592, he did a verse adaptation of the story called The Tragical History of Romeus and Juliet. And Sean is now going to read in his very best original pronunciation the prologue to The Tragical History of Romeus and Juliet.
Love hath inflamed twain by sudden sight, and both do grant the thing that both desire. They wed in shrift by counsel of a friar. Young Romeus climbs fair Juliet's bower by night. 3 months he doth enjoy his chief delight. By Tybalt's rage provoked unto ire, he payeth death to Tybalt for his hire. A banished man he scapes by secret flight. New marriage is offered to his wife. She drinks a drink that seems to reave her breath. They bury her that sleeping yet hath life. Her husband hears the tidings of her death. He drinks his bane, and she with Romeo's knife, when she awakes herself, alas, she slayeth.
That's my favorite line. So just a quick note about the original pronunciation. That is what Shakespeare's audience would have heard. We are not going to do the play or the rest of this evening in it, but I thought it would be fun for you guys to hear that for a moment. And I might point out a couple times in future scenes where that actually makes the rhymes work, that the modern pronunciation means they don't rhyme, but back then the words would have rhymed. So at about the time that Brooke's poem was published, this young poet had just arrived in London, and he was getting a name for himself for a series of poems called Venus and Adonis. And this was pretty much the 50 Shades of Grey of its time. It was very sexy, and every housewife had to have a copy of this little volume. And now Anne's going to give us a little bit of this, and this is for grown-ups only.
Foundling, she saith, since I have hemmed thee here within the circuit of this ivory pale, I'll be a park, and thou shalt be my deer. Feed where thou wilt, on mountain or in dale, graze on my lips, and if those hills be dry, stray lower where the pleasant fountains lie. Within this limit is relief enough, sweet bottom grass and high delightful plain, round rising hillocks, breaks obscure and rough, to shelter thee from tempest and from rain. Then be my deer, since I am such a park. No dog shall rouse thee, though 1,000 bark.
So everyone was reading that, and they were wondering, what is this young man going to come up with next? And rumor had it that he had been writing some new poems in the sonnet form, popularized by Sir Philip Sidney and his sister Mary Sidney in Astrophel and Stella, which was written in 1591. Now, new sonnets, these new sonnets by the Sidneys were different from the Petrarchan sonnets in Italy, instead of a 14-line poem that started with an octet, that's 8 lines, that went, and this is the rhyming, A, B, B, A, B, B, A, where all the A's rhymed and all the B's rhymed. So A, B, B, A, A, B, B, A, followed by a sestet, which was 6 lines, that went C, D, D, E, C, E. This is very hard to remember, but this is what the Italians were doing. Sydney came up with this new rhyme scheme with 4 quatrains followed by a couplet. So it went A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G. Oh my goodness, you can remember that, right? So it's not like a haiku, it's pretty basic. So Petrarch would introduce a problem in the octet, the sort of problem for the poem to solve, and then he would solve it in the sestet. So we had quite a long time to set up the problem and then quite a long time to solve it. The Sydneys set up the problem in the first quatrain, expanded on it, and then very quickly solved it in that final couplet, which kind of makes sonnets really fun, because if you read Shakespeare's sonnets, there's always a little problem that's solved at the end. So the Petrarchan scheme was well-suited for the Italian language, but the new scheme was well-suited for the English language and became very trendy. It was simply constructed. It had that nice little final couplet at the end. It was easy to remember and mathematically satisfying, all the little pairs. So soon Sidney's form had taken off, and all the young men in London were trying to compose these odes to their mistresses. So you can imagine them slaving away. And meanwhile, this young genius from Stratford comes along, and he seems to have been a hired gun for some of the city's theater companies around that time. We don't know that he was a member, a charter member yet, but he seems to have been writing some stuff. He had some popular plays. The Henry VI cycle was a big hit. No one does that one anymore. And then Comedy of Errors and The Taming of the Shrew and Titus Andronicus were also very big. But nothing he'd written yet had really shaken the theatrical firmament. There was no, like, oh my God, this is the greatest guy ever. And his sonnets, which he was probably writing around then, weren't actually published until 1609, but some of his friends were reading them. So they knew they were happening. But we think that they were probably being written around 1594 when he started to write this new play, which would capitalize on this new trend for sonnets. So he first of all started this new play with a sonnet.
Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene, from ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life, whose misadventure piteous overthrows doth with their death bury their parents' strife. The fearful passage of their death-marked love and the continuance of their parents' rage, which but their children's end not could remove, is now the 2 hours' traffic of our stage. The which, if you with patient ears attend, what here shall miss, our toil shall strive to mend.
Just want to point out that at the time, death marked love and not could remove would have rhymed. So that's an example of that original pronunciation. Now, it was totally unheard of at the time to use a sonnet as the prologue. So this was a brand new idea. He also cleverly embedded the twos, the pairs that are so much part of the sonnet form, into there. So two households, the two foes, the pair of star-crossed lovers, the 2 hours traffic of our stage. A lot of people in the theater, you know, a lot of directors get very anxious that, oh my God, Romeo and Juliet has to come in at 2 hours. How do they possibly get this play to be 2 hours long? I theorize that it never was. It's just that he really wanted to have two in the prologue, so he said it was. Plus, that meant that way no one leaves, right? They could say, like, oh, 3 hours, oh God. The 2 hours, okay. So Shakespeare didn't stop there. He actually surpassed himself by including a sonnet in the dialogue, a sonnet spoken by two people. No one had ever done this before. The very first moment that Romeo and Juliet meet, they speak a sonnet together, so they're clearly just meant to be together. It's kind of hard to exaggerate the impact this would have had on the audience at the time. Imagine a very hip new hip-hop musical like Hamilton on Broadway right now, where you're taking a street form of art and then combining it with another popular art form, but taking something really new and combining it with an older tradition. Here's that sonnet.
If I profane with my unworthiest hand this holy shrine, the gentle sin is this: my lips to blushing pilgrims ready stand to smooth that rough touch with a tender kiss.
Good pilgrim, you do wrong your hand too much, which mannerly devotion shows in this. For saints have hands which pilgrims' hands do touch, and palm to palm is holy palmer's kiss.
Have not saints lips and holy palmers too?
High pilgrim, lips that they must use in prayer.
Oh, then, dear saint, let lips do what hands do. They pray, grant thou, lest faith turn to despair.
Saints do not move. though grant for prayer's sake.
Then move not, while my prayer's effect I take.
And they kiss. Oh my God, it ends with a kiss. It's amazing. So the audience went nuts for this new play. This was something, they'd never seen anything like this before. We know that they went nuts for it because there were a lot of unauthorized quartos of the play floating around. That means somebody did their very best to transcribe what they heard, or some actor who had just a little bit of the play then sold what he knew was the play and what else he could remember and got it published. The playwrights didn't really have a lot of interest in publishing their own work, so they came out there, they were illegally published. There's also some references to this play by other writers of the period. I think there was always a lot of annoyance at Shakespeare for being so popular, even though he'd never gone to university and he was some kid from the country. So there was that always pops up in the literature. This play may have well made his reputation and paved the way for the other great tragedies. Well, why do we love it so much? Why have we always loved this play so much? Well, sonnets are not the only thing about this play that are mathematically satisfying. Dualities come up over and over again as we consider the play, starting with the title, Romeo and Juliet. Not only does that include two names, it has a lesser-known subtitle, which is an antithesis, the most excellent and lamentable tragedy of Romeo and Juliet. So you've got these two descriptions in the title. It also straddles two genres. In the first half, the play is clearly a comedy. Everyone's expecting it to be a comedy. And then there's an abrupt turn in Act 3, Scene 1, the death of Mercutio, at which point the play becomes a tragedy. And the couplets, which have been all peppered through the first half of the play, all but disappear. You get almost none in the second half, almost no rhyming in the second half of the play. So listen for that when you go see it. The characters themselves exist in pairs. We have the Montagues and the Capulets, our two rival families. And then we also have, Shakespeare gives Romeo two close friends named Benvolio and Mercutio. Benvolio is nonviolent, and he's in favor of a measured approach to life. And this is what Anne's going to read Benvolio.
I do but keep the peace. Put up thy sword, or manage it to part these men with me.
While Mercutio, Sean, is reckless and chaotic.
Oh, calm, dishonorable, vile submission. Alla Stuccato carries it away. Tybalt, you rat catcher, will you walk?
Each lover also has an older advisor who is not their parent. Juliet has the nurse, and Romeo has the friar. Paris is presented as a looking-glass Romeo, Juliet's lover that might have been, so she's got both Romeo and Paris. Romeo also has two loves. He has Rosalind, who we never meet, that he gets talked about a lot in the first act, and then ultimately Juliet. The servants appear in pairs in the opening scene. We have two servants, Sean's one of them, you'll see, Abram and Samson and Gregory, and then they fight with Abram and an unnamed Montague servant. So you have this group of four fighting. The language itself is very famously full of dualities and dichotomies. Scholars are always talking about the light versus dark and day versus night imagery in the play. It's so plentiful that it's impossible to read it all for you. But let's look at the speech of Juliet's.
Gallop apace, you fiery-footed steeds, toward Phoebus' lodging. Such a wagoner as Fain would whip you to the west and bring in cloudy night immediately. Spread thy close curtain, love-performing night, that runaway's eyes may wink, and Romeo leap to these arms, untalked of and unseen. Lovers can see to do their amorous rites, and by their own beauties. Or, if love be blind, it best agrees with night. Come, civil knight, thou sober-suited matron all in black, and learn me how to lose a winning match, played for a pair of stainless maidenhoods, hood my unmanned blood baiting in my cheeks, till strange love grow bold, think true love acted simple modesty. Come, knight, come, Romeo, come, thou day and night, for thou wilt lie upon the wings of night, whiter than new snow upon a raven's back. Come, gentle knight, come, loving, black-browed knight, give me my Romeo. And when I shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun.
Get Romeo very associated with night and darkness and sneaking through the night. Juliet gets associated with the moon, with the sun. Envious moon, here comes the sun, here's Juliet. So there's a lot of contrast in their language. We also have this farewell scene before Romeo is banished to Mantua, which contrasts day and night and the lark and the nightingale.
Wilt thou be gone? It is not yet near day. It was the nightingale and not the lark that pierced the fearful hollow of thine ear. Nightly she sings on yon pomegranate tree. Believe me, love, it was the nightingale.
It was the lark, the herald of the morn, no nightingale. Look, love, what envious streaks do lace the severing clouds in yonder east. Night's candles are burnt out, and jocund day stands tiptoe on the misty mountaintops. I must be gone and live, or stay and die.
Yon light is not daylight, I know it, It is some meteor the sun exhales, to be to thee this night a torchbearer, and light thee on thy way to Mantua. Therefore stay yet, thou needst not to be gone.
Let me be ta'en. Let me be put to death. I am content, so thou wilt have it so. I'll say yon gray is not the morning's eye. Tis but the pale reflex of Cynthia's brow. Nor that is not the lark whose notes do beat the vaulty heaven so high above our heads. I have more care to stay than will to go. Come death and welcome, Juliet wills it so. How is't my soul? Let's talk, it is not day.
It is, I hence be gone away. It is the lark that sings so out of tune, straining harsh discords and unpleasing sharps. Some say the lark makes sweet division. This doth not so, for she divideth us. Some say the lark and loathed toad change eyes. Oh, now I would they had changed voices too, since arm from arm that voice doth us affray, hunting thee hence with hunts up to the day. Oh, now be gone, more light and light it grows.
More light and light, more dark and dark our woes.
There it is. It's really obvious in this play. He gets much more subtle in his later career, but this one he's like puts it right out there. It's also interesting to note that the structure of the play reflects that most of the scenes in the play take place either in the middle of the night or at dawn. So when you're watching it, you know, it's something to keep an eye out for. One of the dawn scenes is the friar's very first encounter with Romeo after he meets Juliet. He's been up all night long. But before he comes in, the friar has this wonderful speech, which is a feast of antithetical structure, with each couplet providing two contrasting ideas about the same thing. And Sean's going to be the friar for us for a moment.
The gray-eyed morn smiles on the frowning night, checkering the eastern clouds with streaks of light. And fleckled darkness like a drunkard reels from forth day's path and Titan's burning wheels. Now ere the sun advance his burning eye, the day to cheer and night's dank dew to dry, I must upfill this osier cage of ours with baleful weeds and precious juiced flowers.
Good and bad things.
The earth, that's nature's mother, is her tomb. What is her burying grave, that is her womb. And from her womb, children of diverse kind, we sucking on her natural bosom find. Many for many virtues excellent, none but for some, and yet all different. O mickle is the powerful grace that lies in plants, herbs, stones, and their true qualities. For not so vile that on the earth doth live, but to the earth some special good doth give. Nor aught so good, but strained from that fair use, revolts from true birth, stumbling on abuse. Virtue itself turns vice, being misapplied, and vice sometime by action dignified. Within the infant rind of this weak flower, poison hath residence and medicine power. For this being smelt, with that part cheers each part, being tasted slays all senses with the heart. To such opposed kings encamp them still, in man as well as herbs, grace, and rude will. And where the worser is predominant, full soon the canker death eats up that plant.
So this is a very important speech that would seem to have absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the play. It's just a friar talking about plants, except for that he's absolutely got the entire theme of the play in this speech. People cut the speech a lot from the play because it's long and it's about plants. But if you're listening carefully, all those dichotomies, all those setting up are about the themes of the play. The reverse of comedy is tragedy. The reverse of passionate love is violent hate. Anything that skews the balance makes things go really, really badly. So again, this play, the balance gets skewed too far toward the bad. It's part of the human condition for those two things to exist. A plant can both be poison and medicine, but the fact is you have to know how to make it good and make it right. And the friar does know, but then he screws up a bit. But the friar himself, actually, at this point in the play, preaches moderation. He preaches that kind of balance between the good and the bad, the dark and the light. And this time, Sean's going to be Romeo, and Anne's going to be the friar.
Oh, let us hence. I stand on sudden hast.
Wisely and slow, they stumble that run fast.
An example of original pronunciation that we've thrown in to make that rhyme. And later, friar again.
These violent delights have violent ends, and in their triumph die like fire and powder, which as they kiss, consume. The sweetest honey is loathsome in his own deliciousness, and in the taste confounds the appetite. Therefore, love moderately. Long love doth so. Too swift arrives as tardy as too slow.
Throughout the play, the friar is constantly going, slow down, slow down, if only they would pay attention to the friar. Instead, there's like 3 days pass, and then it's all over, and it just doesn't go well. But again, we have couplets. Again, we have the parallel construction of the good and bad being contrasted there. When the friar's fears prove true and Romeo kills Tybalt rashly and is banished, then Juliet responds with a speech that's just a shower of antitheses.
Oh, serpent heart hid with a flowering face, did ever dragon keep so fair a cave? Beautiful tyrant, fiend angelical, ravenous dove-feathered raven, wolfish ravening lamb, despised substance of divinest show, just opposite to what thou justly seem'st, a damned saint, an honorable villain. Oh, nature, what hadst thou to do in hell when thou didst bower the spirit of a fiend in mortal paradise of such sweet flesh? Was ever book containing such vile matter so fairly bound? Oh, that deceit should dwell in such a gorgeous palace.
It's just what the friar was saying, that you can have good and bad in the same person, just like in the same plant. So the poetry and the rhetoric of Romeo and Juliet, which utilize all these dualities, are part of what makes the play so satisfying to us as an audience. We respond well to dualities as human beings. And even the rhythm of the poetry, the human heart is drawn to the beat of the iamb, which is da-dum, 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 da-dum. It's our heart that makes that sound, and it's a two-beat rhythm. And so it's like our minds and our bodies are just kind of programmed to respond to things in sets of twos, like our paired genetic material just needs to kind of have couplings in everything. So I think there's something very visceral going on with this play and the way that we respond to it. In this production that hopefully you will see in the next 3 weeks, we've explored another duality in the play, which is the two generations. On the one hand, we have the older folks, the middle-aged parents and advisors, the Lord and Lady Capulet, Lord and Lady Montague, the nurse and the friar. And Juliet says about these older people,
"Had she affections and warm youthful blood, she would be as swift in motion as a ball. My words would bandy her to my sweet love and his to me. But old folks, many feign as they were dead, unwieldy, slow, heavy, and pale as lead."
So just like the friar is saying, please go slowly, Juliet's saying, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. So the kids want everything to happen faster, and the parents' generation is perceived as slow and out of touch, and they have no idea what their children are doing. Meanwhile, the children are living this entirely separate life from them, probably like some children today on their phones or whatever, and many of the servants might have a separate life too, and they're of that generation. And Lord Montague says to Benvolio a little bit about what's going on between him and his son. And Sean's going to be Lord Montague, and then Anne is going to be Benvolio.
"Many a morning hath he there been seen, with tears augmenting the fresh morning's dew, adding to clouds more clouds with his deep sighs. But also soon as the all-cheering sun should in the farthest east begin to draw the shady curtains from Aurora's bed, away from light steals home my heavy son, and private in his chamber pens himself, shuts up his window, locks fair daylight out, and makes himself an artificial night. Black and portentous must this humor prove, unless good counsel may the cause remove."
"My noble uncle, do you know the cause?"
"I neither know it, nor can learn of him."
"Have you importuned him by any means?"
"Both by myself and many other friends. But he, his own affection's counselor, is to himself, I will not say how true, but to himself so secret and so close, so far from sounding and discovery, as is the bud bit with an envious worm, ere he can spread his sweet leaves to the air or dedicate his beauty to the same. Could we but learn from whence his sorrows grow, we would as willingly give cure as no."
That last couplet really struck me when I read the play and was about to direct it, because I don't think it's often done. People often cut it. The idea is, if I only knew what was going on with my kid, I could fix it. I could fix what's happening. And so that really demonstrates the generational divide here. And if they would just talk to each other, slow down, speed up, whatever they need to do to get to the same space, then the whole thing might have turned out differently. Juliet and Romeo never do tell their parents about their love. They've been poisoned by this ancient feud that they inherited. It was not their fault. The generations are divided by this feud, even though it's that one thing that they have in common. And so Romeo and Juliet were doomed to die, coming as they did from forth the fatal loins of these two foes, the fatal there being both ordained by fate and fatal, deadly. This play ends not with the scene that you probably all remember, which is the two lovers committing suicide, but that happens by like line 169 of the scene, and then there are 150 lines after that. So it's important not to entirely cut those lines, because otherwise we end up with this sort of glorification of suicide and the youthful choices that have been made. And we were very careful about this with this production. We're like, that is not the end. The kids are dead. What happens to the community? What happens to the society? And the older members of the society then have to come to terms with what's just happened. And of the six young people that I've mentioned, Benvolio, Tybalt, Romeo, Juliet, Paris, who am I forgetting?
Mercutio,
thank you. Only Benvolio is left alive. Only the one who preaches moderation is left alive. And he's not usually even in that final scene, although he is in ours because we've added him in. So this is a massive community crisis. It's a crisis that needs to be resolved in order for this tragedy to have any kind of positive outcome, to have any kind of catharsis. And so Shakespeare does not end the play until the families are on the path to recovery. We're going to have Anne read Lord Capulet, and this is actually Lady Montague in our production, but we'll gender swap here, so she's not going to be Lady Montague.
Oh, brother Montague, give me thy hand. This is my daughter's jointure, for no more can I demand.
But I can give thee more, for I will raise her statue in pure gold, that whilst Verona by that name is known, there shall no figure at that rate be set as that of true and faithful Juliet.
As rich shall Romeo by his lady lie, poor sacrifices of our enmity.
Notice we did a little bit of lie and enmity in order to make that nice rhyme there. One final note on the structure of the play, which I believe also conforms very subtly to the sonnet structure. And this is an argument that I don't think I've ever heard anyone else make, but we had some fun with it. So once again, let's hear the prologue in sections. We've got one quatrain, ABAB, that sets up the problem.
Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene, from ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean.
So in that quatrain, there is no mention of Romeo or Juliet. It's all about the parents. It's all about their problem, the older generation's dilemma. What are they going to do about these warring families? What is the prince, the ruler, going to do about the situation? We have the Capulet's attempt to create good relationships with the prince through the ball and the engagement of Juliet to Rome, to Paris. And we also have the family's reaction to the deaths of Tybalt and Mercutio, Romeo's banishment. The older generation has this whole other play going on. They don't know anything about this romance, and they're still trying to solve a problem. Meanwhile, we have the second quatrain.
From forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life, whose misadventured piteous overthrows doth with their death bury their parents' strife.
Well, that's the plot that we remember. So we've got that overarching plot of the parents, and now we've got the Romeo and Juliet's doomed love story, which is that plot that's going underneath all that. Even though they're not mentioned in this quatrain, the friar and the nurse are deeply involved, of course, in that plot. Last quatrain.
The fearful passage of their death-marked love and the continuance of their parents' rage, which but their children's end not could remove, is now the 2 hours' traffic of our stage.
So we have the two threads, the fearful passage of their death-marked love, the continuance of their parents' rage, which then get wrapped in together, and we're going to solve this all in 2 hours. So everyone sit tight, we'll do this. So we have both threads all being wrapped up tidily. And then we have a little twist at the end of our final couplet is a little twist. And so the final couplet is...
The which, if you with patient ears attend, what here shall miss, our toil shall strive to mend.
So this sounds like a very traditional prologue thing to say. It was very traditional in the period to say, we're so sorry, we're terrible, and we hope that everybody will forgive us for being so bad. Or they would say it during the epilogue, and they would just beg for the audience's forgiveness. So again, very traditional couplet. It doesn't seem to have a lot to do with the plot of the play. It's just a humble request for the audience's patience. But read more closely, it is an argument for the two essential things in human relationships. Patience from one half, and hard work on the other. The which, if you with patient ears attend, what to hear shall miss, our toil shall strive to mend. We will work hard to make it better. So this, if everyone would pay attention, a little patience and a little hard work would have solved the whole problem. So Shakespeare very cleverly gets that in. It's also that we are bringing in now, we've got the two strands of the plot, we've got the parents, we've got the kids, and the whole thing is pointless without the audience. It's the whole reason we do this. So we bring in that third element that makes the whole play happen there at the end. So we're inviting you to be part of the solution, to have patience and work hard to make us all feel better about the situation. So that's our thoughts on this play. Thank you all so much for paying attention and listening so attentively. I'd like to open it up to some questions. I really hope that some of this will enhance your enjoyment of the play, that you'll be able to listen for those couplets, for those ideas between the light and the dark in the production. Until then,
good night, good night. Parting is such sweet sorrow that I shall say good night till it be morrow.
But you don't have to go. You can ask some questions before we say goodbye. Yes.
He kind of alluded to it, like the two time frames, just night and dawn. Can you just kind of explain like the relevance of why that's important?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I think it's got to do with the sort of the light and the dark thing that Shakespeare once wanted to come across. There's something about the secrecy of things that happen in the night, and then the dawn kind of bringing the things clarity. The most important scene for that is Act 5, Scene 3, the very last scene of the play. Starts in the middle of the night. Everyone's going to this tomb to do illegal and terrible things. And then gradually dawn comes up over the course of the scene. And so when we have those final lines with the families, the sun has risen on this new world in which the kids are all dead and the parents have to deal with it. So there's, you know, light comes out. And light, for the Elizabethans, light would have been about knowledge, and darkness would have been about anxiety and not lack of knowledge and lots of things that go bump in the night. There are a lot of superstitions. So, and yet, in the play, there's also wonderful things associated with night, like Romeo coming at night. So it's not all one thing. He was doing some subtle stuff with it. That's a good question. Thank you. Yeah.
I guess I wanted to make more of a comment than a question, but I have, you know, seen the play and the movies with that dramatic suicide scene at the end with the poison and the whole deal.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that there was more to the play. So thank you for adding the section where it actually has some cohesive meaning to it.
Yeah, I hope that you'll get a chance to. Ending.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's in those 150 lines, there's a lot of repetition of what's already happened in the play. So as a director, you want to give just enough to the audience that you're not repeating everything they already know. For the Elizabethans, sometimes it was like, well, you were all not paying attention in this part, so we're going to go back over what happened. Whereas now we tend to be a little more attentive theater goers and we don't necessarily need all that. The friar has a very long speech where he reiterates every single thing that just happened in the play. We tried doing the whole speech and we felt like, oh my God, we know all this. And so we reduced it down to the things that the characters on stage didn't know. And tried to make that more interesting, and I'll be curious to hear what you think. But we did try to really make a point of, that's awful that the kids are dead, but that's not the end of the story. We want people to leave with a sense of hope that things might get better at this point. The prince says, go forth and have, go hence, thank you, I'll get it right, go hence and have more talk of these sad things, and that's the message we want people to leave with, is like, go out and talk about the problems in our culture of groups that hate each other for no reason, people that can't get along, violence that happens for terrible traditions that we should all get over. The families come around pretty quickly. I think the families, Lord Capulet and Lord Montague, clearly are not, they have some vestigial hatred of each other, but they have greater concerns. They're much more concerned about their kids. They don't understand their kids, they're much more concerned about them. And so it's a big turnaround at the end, it's not that. Like, they're ready for it. They're primed. They're culturally ready to say goodbye to this feud, and they're given an enormously good reason to do so. So, yeah.
Do you think the play is better enjoyed at the 4 o'clock time or the 7:30 time?
That's a really good question. We don't know because we haven't seen it at the 4 o'clock time yet. I think, you know, the thing about Romeo and Juliet that really is nice at night is that the comedy is in the first half when it's light, and then the tragedy is in the second half when it's dark. So, that, you know, it's kind of perfectly constructed, but it ends at the dawn.
Yeah.
The thing with the 4 o'clock time is that you'll have to be very imaginative about when it's dark, because it really won't be. But Shakespeare's audience would have probably seen it at 1 or 2 in the afternoon. So one of the reasons that Shakespeare's constantly harping on what time of day it is because he had to remind everybody all the time that it's actually dark right now. And they're constantly going, I can't see anything! Lanterns! You know, so that we remember that they can't see anything. So I always enjoy watching the show at the 4 o'clock because it's the shared light of audience and actor, and that is so much more Elizabethan. So I like that a lot. But there's also something about getting to have lights, you know. It does add to the mood when you're sitting in the dark for the second dark and sad half. So,
see it twice.
I'm very curious. I always, you know, there were some things in Macbeth 2 years ago where when we finally got to the afternoon shows, I was like, oh, that's what's going on in that scene, because it was so dark that I couldn't actually tell. So I liked to see it in the light. There were some subtleties that I had missed that were there. So that was fun. Anyone else? Good questions. Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure what kind of question this is, but I've noticed. So I took my kids last year to see
Taming of the Shrew,
and then this year Broadway by the Bay is putting on the West Side Story, and I'm missing Kate.
I know.
And
isn't that great?
Yes. Yeah, so I find this. I find it really cool, and actually, my kids will see West Side Story first.
Oh, great. We're trying to figure out some way to like co-publicize those two shows because it's such a good match.
Right, and I just think it's so interesting, as you're saying, these things have been carried through, and we've seen so many different adaptations, and I think that West Side Story in particular does very well in talking about this whole, you know, it's ridiculous cultural antagonism for no good reason.
Very much so.
And I just wonder if you could talk about the different ways that people have looked at.
I can, and I would also recommend, we have a wonderful green show at 7 o'clock and 3:30, depending on when you come, it's half an hour before the showtime, where they do a little bit about some of the other things that were based on this story. Yeah, it's. I think this one is very fun and has some of the similar educational stuff, but they talk a little bit about West Side Story. They talk a lot about how other adaptations have changed the ending, that West Side Story actually surprised the audience by having Maria, the Juliet character, live at the end, that she decides not to kill herself. So that was really surprising to people. And then, you know, there's the movie Romeo and Juliet. I was like, oh my God, they made a kid's movie out of this? And then I found out that nobody dies at the end and that even Tybalt, who's supposedly dead, comes back to life at the end. So they really made
it's really
fun. Kid-friendly. I hear great things about it, and now I will see it. I have to see it. But I also would say that that's not the first time that that's been done. In the 1800s, people really didn't like the ending, and so they made funny comedy versions where everybody came back to life at the end. It's in the book Nicholas Nickleby. If you've read Charles Dickens' Nicholas Nickleby, there's a theater troupe, in like a sort of traveling, goofy theater troupe, that do the fun, happy version of Romeo and Juliet, where everybody's alive at the end. So there's something about, I don't know any other tragedies that people have had that instinct with. It really is this play. I think King Lear, there's a version where Cordelia lives. But is there Olivia? Yeah, there's a version. But there's something about the instinct to kind of fix the problem at the end that makes people sometimes want to have some survivors. West Side Story in particular does it so well. And I think West Side Story is fantastic. I'm so glad that Redwood City audiences have the opportunity to see both of those plays in the same period. It's just like, it was just pure luck. I mean, San Francisco Ballet did Romeo and Juliet this year to great acclaim. And so people have been actually telling me at various events, like, oh, we saw the ballet, it was so great, now we're going to see the play. So just a fortunate coincidence. So, hooray. The Kiss Me, Kate, too, which is a very much looser adaptation, I think, of it, but also very fun.
But I think it also helps, especially for younger kids, to realize that these are ideas and tropes and themes that have been around for hundreds of years. And,
yes.
It's worth looking at the way they did it in the 16th and 17th
Absolutely.
Century and comparing it to now. And,
yeah, I mean, I sort of wish someone would do one of those 19th century happy ending Romeo and Juliet. It's like, wouldn't that be fun to see? Like, how they do that? It'd be sort of a hoot. A sort of panto style, really silly plays.
Have you ever seen the Big Lebowski version? They did it.
Yeah, I've heard of it. I haven't seen it. Yeah.
So fun. Just because of what you're seeing, there was so much joy in it.
Yeah.
I mean,
like,
it's such a good job. It was like the Big Lebowski, which is a film that I happen to really like, and it was written in Shakespearean.
That's right. They did it, and there's the new Star Wars books that are out that are all done in Shakespearean style verse, which apparently are quite clever.
But
I haven't read all of
them.
Yeah, this is performed. So it's
different.
Very ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, it's just something. Well, that was the Two Gentlemen of the Lebowski, right? Like they did it based on Two Gentlemen of Verona, which is a very silly play anyway. So it is. It just brings, like you said, these ideas are so much part of the culture that for children who even they see Romeo and Juliet long before they see Romeo and Juliet, they will go, that's the thing that everyone says. Oh, what light through yonder window breaks? I've heard that before. Where does that come from? And that's one of the joys of doing this play for children. They go, that! You know? So, and then hopefully the Mercutio's jokes all go, like, right over their head. Because they're pretty dirty. Anything else before we bid you a good evening? Yes?
Just talk a little bit about your decisions on a play, a given play? I mean, you don't have a huge opportunity to do lots of plays all at once.
We do one, and then we do a tour show. Yeah, we do a touring show that's a very short version of a play that's during the year. And that is often decided by what students are studying in school, so that's got some things. We have a little meeting as the resident artist company, and we talk about some plays that we feel relevance is very important to us. So I became artistic director just over 2 years ago. I knew that Taming of the Shrew and Romeo and Juliet were going to be my first two productions because, as a woman and a feminist, I find Taming of the Shrew very prickly and interesting and difficult, and so I really wanted to tackle that. And I had done so before, and I wanted to do it again. And then Romeo and Juliet is just one of my great, great loves. It's not really a problem play. It's kind of fabulous and perfect, but it's hard to screw up. Hopefully we haven't. But it's also, again, the language is so extraordinary. All the couplings and the antitheses and all that are so wonderful to work with. So it just felt, and we hadn't done it in so long. We hadn't done it in like 20 plus years in the park. So it was time, you know. People were saying, why haven't we done Romeo and Juliet in so long? And so we were totally ready. As a company. Now, and then we had our meeting. We decided to do The Winter's Tale next year, which was not on my, you know, sort of short bucket listy thing, but it was really speaking to the artists. And I think, if you guys want to chime in there, but I think one of the reasons was it's about believing something that is totally untrue, that all facts imply are untrue, like all facts prove that it isn't true, and yet this person insists on believing it. And there's something about that with sort of climate change denial and all kinds of things going on in our culture that interested our company. And then there's something also about forgiveness and redemption in the play, about how people can change and how families can reunite, that people found very moving and stirring. So it wasn't as relevant as like, look at the terrible violence in our streets, Romeo and Juliet will always be relevant because of all that kind of stuff. It was something a little bit more thought-based and a little deeper that to explore. So we'll be really... I'm curious to find out what we find as a company when we look at that play. It's a very, very beautiful play. It has the absolutely backward structure for Free Shakespeare in the Park. It's all tragic at the beginning and then funny at the end. So we're like, how can we get people not to leave at intermission because everything gets better? so that's the goal. We haven't done it in like 13, 14 years. And one of the reasons was that we found... It's a difficult play to balance well for a free audience. Like, how do you not depress the heck out of everyone so that they all leave and don't want to come back? So it's pretty rough. But yeah, it's a big process. We've got some other ones that we feel like, you know, we feel like Hamlet is due really soon because we haven't done Hamlet outdoors. We want to do that. Sean was advocating for Richard III this year, next year, because it's an election year, and we thought the politics of that would be really fun to play with. And then we just noticed that a lot of productions of Richard III were getting done. Marin Shakes is doing it this season, partially because that skeleton was found in that parking lot, so people are really into Richard III. Mm-hmm. So we'll do that soon. We love that play, so it's a super fun play for us. So there's some plays that don't work so well because of the fact that we want things to be family-friendly. We were just talking in the car on the way up. We love Measure for Measure. It's a very difficult play to do without... You can't describe it on the back of the postcard without describing a lot of things that are very dark and sexual. So we don't think that that's necessarily the best Free Shakespeare in the Park show. We might do it another way. We're doing it this fall with some of our older teen groups, and we'll be exploring some of those themes about power and how people use sexuality for power as power. So... very dark, so not sure we'll be seeing that on the Free Shake stage anytime soon, but it's a great play. I love it. It's a wonderful play.
Titus might be a little difficult.
Titus is really nasty. Everyone's always going, why aren't we doing Titus? I'm like, because rape and chopping off hands and eating people and all that stuff. It's not really like family friendly. So, you know, you've always got to keep doing Midsummer Night's Dream every once in a while because everybody loves Midsummer Night's Dream. It was the first play I ever saw. You know, you got to do it every once in a while. So hope that helps.
Thank you.
And answers the question. It is a committee effort. We talk a lot about stuff. Yeah. Thanks so much. Such great questions. I think John's going to come up and draw a name to win.
Well, somebody will draw a name. Did everybody get a raffle slip? Who wants one?
There we go. Oh, more. More one raffle slip.
That's George's truck was in there. Good luck. And let me give you guys. When you guys want to talk about whatever other programs are there, you want to hit me.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So we can tell you a little bit about some other stuff that we do, particularly on the peninsula. We're halfway through our run of Free Shakespeare in the Park, and then in the fall we're going to be doing a tour of Hamlet, actually. And what library is? Are we coming here with Hamlet yet? Or
I don't think we're scheduled here as of yet.
As of yet, but I know we go to some libraries on the peninsula, and that we put that schedule on our website at sfshakes.org of where we come and do for free our tour of Hamlet. That's an hour-long tour designed to go into schools with five actors playing all the roles, so it's always a hoot. And a great cast this year, so that'll be starting up in October. And then we also have some education programs going year-round. We do a camp in San Mateo that's for the year-round schools. They do a two-week program where they do a play at the end of that. So if you know any people between 7 and 13 years old, that's a great program. We're just wrapping up our summer camps now, so those are almost done, but the year-round ones are about to start up. And we do some programs, in after-school programs and residencies. So if you happen to know of a school that's looking to do an active, on-your-feet way to teach Shakespeare, working with English teachers to get Shakespeare more exciting and more active, particularly high schools and middle schools where they start doing this stuff, we will send wonderful artists like these into the school to do fun, on-your-feet, performing-style activities to get those plays alive. And we do everything from, like, we go in for one day and we do something, or sometimes we do, like, a two-week residency if that's what the school wants. We do an after-school program. We'll do like our little mini Renaissance fair sometimes to get people excited about Shakespeare. So really, we want all students in California to have the opportunity to love Shakespeare and not just think of it as boring and something they have to sit around and read. It should be performed, it should be watched, it should be lively and engaging and not just something to stare at. That's not the way to do it. So what
about our adult education program?
Oh,
is that only
I
see some adults out there in the crowd.
I see some adults here. I always forget this one. So if you're interested in The Winter's Tale, this is in San Francisco. It's just off Union Square, very convenient to public transit. So
that's
always
good.
There's some flyers. I will be teaching three Monday night classes about The Winter's Tale in October. October 5th, 12th, and 19th. Those are 2.5-hour classes. We have a really good time. We basically start working on, I use you as dramaturgs, we work on the play together, we talk about the themes of the play. I bring in the designers to start talking about the costumes and the sound, the music, and the dancing that we're going to have in the show. We have some of the actors come in and read from the play. We do some little performing exercises around the play. You're not expected to be an actor in any way, shape, or form. It's really just about appreciation. In the fall, we're going to talk about the first half of the play, the tragedy, Cecilia, the dark winter kingdom. And then in the spring, we're going to talk about Bohemia, the really fun sheep shearing festival and fun, delightful comedy parts of the play. It's very nicely divided in terms of season. And so we'll just these three classes. It's $125 for three classes, which is a very good rate for adult education classes. And they get a discount if you sign up for the second session in the spring, too. So sign up for those. It'll be really fun. I had a great time. We had about 9 or 10 students last year doing Romeo and Juliet. And honestly, they heard me say it many times, but they helped me direct the play. So their input, their ideas.
To learn more about the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival, subscribe to this podcast or visit us at sfshakes.org.